You're with us for The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. You have a line to Attorney General Josh Call this morning. Wisconsin will get a piece of a $1.6 billion settlement with the largest maker of generic opioid pain pills in the country, and the company is Mallinckrodt. The Attorney General announced the agreement last week. Wisconsin also joined a multi-state investigation into vaping company Juul. So how do you think Wisconsin should handle legal settlements involving state government? Should the legislature have a hand in these settlements? How do you feel about the lawsuit against pharmaceutical companies making opioids? Where do you think the settlement money should go? We're at 800-642-1234. Josh Call is the Attorney General of Wisconsin. Attorney General Call, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me again, Kate.
So we've learned more details about the victims and the shooter at Molson Coors in Milwaukee. And Governor Evers and State Representative Jonathan Brostoff of Milwaukee, they've used this moment to talk more about gun violence. What are your thoughts following this shooting?
Well, first, what happened in Milwaukee is just awful. I mean, we have seen these kind of tragic mass shootings around the country, and to see another one happen here in Wisconsin is really just gut-wrenching. DOJ has responded to the scene when this happened. Our Division of Criminal Investigation assisted and continues to assist with the investigation. And our Office of Crime Victim Services is available to provide support to people who've been impacted by this tragedy as well. So, my heart goes out to those who've been impacted. I do agree with the governor and with Representative Brostoff that we should be taking steps that we know can help prevent these kind of tragedies. There's no silver bullet. There's nothing that's going to stop all mass shootings. But there are steps that can help make our communities safer and reduce the likelihood that these will happen.
Are these policy steps?
And I think we need to take action.
Are these policy steps that you're talking about?
They are. That's right. I mean, I've been a vocal advocate for common sense gun safety measures. I think we need universal background checks and a red flag law, a law that would allow law enforcement officers or a family member to take action when somebody has been shown to a judge to be a danger to themselves or others. And we need the legislature to finally come together and have hearings on this issue and hopefully get something done.
So last Tuesday, you visited HSHS Sacred Heart Hospital in Eau Claire to discuss mental health. Why is mental health important to the DOJ?
A number of people who come into contact with the criminal justice system struggle with behavioral health issues, either a mental health issue or a substance use disorder. And by addressing those challenges, we can make our community safer. We can make it less likely that crime happens, and we can help people get treatment rather than ending up in the criminal justice system. So if we can strengthen the way that we're responding to those behavioral health issues, we're going to have safer communities. And when people do end up in the system, making sure that they get the help that they need to address their underlying issue, whether it's trauma or a mental health issue or a substance use disorder, can help reduce the likelihood that they're going to end up back in the criminal justice system. Which means better outcomes for those people, and it means safer communities because they're less likely to recidivate.
There was a bill that would give Sacred Heart and St. Joseph's Hospital $15 million more to expand and provide 22 psych beds. And State Senator Kathy Bernier told WQOW in Eau Claire that she expected it would pass despite limited time for lawmakers in session.
All the Democrats on the Assembly voted in favor. And so I expect that the Democrats in the Senate side will also vote in favor. And I haven't heard that anyone in my caucus, Republican caucus, is against. As far as I know, they're all in favor as well. So I expect it should be unanimous.
So with this funding, if it's passed, how would this bill help alleviate some of these mental health challenges?
One of the big challenges we face is with our emergency detention system in Wisconsin, and that's the system that applies if an individual has been identified by law enforcement due to a mental health issue or a substance abuse issue to be a danger to themselves or others, and a crisis intervention takes place. Right now, there's only one state facility that accepts all patients who are facing emergency detention, and that's in Winnebago County. And what happens as a result is that officers are transporting people who have been detained for emergency detentions, sometimes hours across the state to get to Winnebago County. The process is also cumbersome because it involves a medical clearance at a local hospital before somebody's transported to Winnebago County. It's bad for police because it means they're spending a lot of time in that process. And it's bad for people going through a mental health crisis because when we should be trying to get them access to treatment, they're instead going through this lengthy process. So by adding more mental health beds and by improving our emergency detention process, we can help get treatment to people who are going through a crisis faster, and we can save law enforcement resources that are currently being used in the transport process, which means more time can be spent by those officers working to keep our communities safe.
Talking with Josh Call, the Attorney General of Wisconsin, we're catching up with him on a range of issues involving work at the Justice Department. You can join in. Are you affected by the opioid crisis? How so? How has it hit home? What kind of responsibility do you feel pharmaceutical companies should have for combating addictions? We're at 800-642-1234 for you to join in. Email ideas at WPR.org. Attorney General, let's look at opioids. Wisconsin will get a share of this $1.6 billion settlement with the largest maker of generic opioid pills. And what are the guidelines, the framework for how this money should be used?
Well, right now, the details of that resolution are still in the process of being worked out. This is part of our broader strategy for how we're fighting the epidemic. I want to increase access to treatment in Wisconsin. I think we need to keep working to prevent people from becoming addicted to opioids or other substances. And we need accountability. And that includes accountability from pharmaceutical companies that engaged in false and deceptive marketing practices. Those companies made billions and billions of dollars off of this epidemic, and recovering funds that were obtained because of illegal marketing and sales practices means that we can get more funds to communities in Wisconsin to help support treatment and prevention. And so this is the resolution with one of the companies that was involved in opioid sales and marketing. This company is going to go into a bankruptcy, and there's going to be a bankruptcy process that will ultimately impact how the funds are allocated. But I want to see as many resources as possible from these resolutions going to support efforts that are going to abate the epidemic through treatment, through prevention, and through enforcement efforts.
Can you tell us about any updates on the status of the lawsuits from last year with Purdue Pharma and its chairman, Richard Sackler, former chairman?
Last year, we filed suit against two Purdue Pharma entities and Richard Sackler. That case right now is on hold because Purdue went into bankruptcy. Approximately half of the states in the country entered into a proposed settlement agreement with Purdue. We rejected that offer. I don't think it goes far enough when it comes to holding members of the Sackler family for their role in this epidemic. So the bankruptcy process is underway, and what happens in bankruptcy will impact ultimately how that case comes out. But again, our goal there is to maximize the recovery for the state of Wisconsin so we can get funds to our communities to help fight this epidemic.
We're talking with Attorney General Josh Call about pressing issues at the Justice Department. What questions do you have for the Attorney General? Are you a survivor of sexual assault? What do you think of how the state handles these cases? What do you think of the recent legislative impasse and the stalled legislation to prevent a future backlog of testing rape kits? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Attorney General Josh Call right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we have Attorney General Josh Call on the line. We're touching down on a number of issues and priorities at the Justice Department, including stalled legislation on sexual assault kits. Are you a survivor of sexual assault? What do you think of how the state handles these cases? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. and Attorney General Josh Call stays with us. Let's go to the phones now with Mary joining us from Bayfield County this morning. Hi, Mary.
Hi. My question is about how are we going to rate treatment centers? I hear a lot in the news about we need to increase access to treatment for people struggling with substance use disorders. And based on what I've seen with family members and such, they're not very effective. I mean, I think that with opioids and meth, they have something like a 5% sobriety success rate after a year. And I'm just wondering how we are going to start, you know, making sure that these treatment centers, some of them which are for-profit treatment centers, actually are effective.
Delivering on results. Attorney General?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for that question. You know, when I was at Sacred Heart the other day, one of the things that we were talking about is the fact that often people need to return to treatment multiple times before ultimately treatment programs are successful. So, first of all, I encourage anybody who's had experiences with the process, but it hasn't been successful, to continue working at it, because the more times that people are able to attempt to get treatment, the more likely it is to be successful. But it is important that we look at the results that different facilities are having, and that we assess them based on how well people are doing once they've completed the treatment program. And one of the things that, you know, we talked about when I was at Sacred Heart is that it's often the case that people who end up with a substance use disorder also have other challenges they're facing. It's common to have.
Oh, and I think we just lost the Attorney General. Oh, are you still there, Attorney General? Can you hear us?
I am, yes.
Okay, carry on. You just dropped for a moment.
Sorry about that. I was mentioning that often people who have a mental health issue have some sort of co-occurring disorder, perhaps a mental health issue. And working to address those issues and also to provide any additional services, helping people get access to housing, stable employment, all those things contribute to successful recovery. And so making sure that we provide those kind of wraparound services can help people get back on their feet and beat their addictions.
Mary, thanks for the call. Attorney General, at the State of the Tribes address a few weeks ago, we heard Chairman of Forest County Potawatomi Community, Ned Daniels Jr., made a call for something to be done about opioids. Let's listen.
Native communities across Wisconsin have been hit especially hard by the opioid epidemic. There are hundreds of families like mine who are now caring for the young ones of relatives because of opioid addiction.
The state health department says Native Americans had the highest rate of opioid deaths of any ethnic group in 2018. What plans does the Justice Department currently have to work with tribes on this issue?
It's critical that we work together to fight this epidemic. And one of the ways we're doing that at the Department of Justice is on the enforcement side. We have a partnership that involves local, state, federal and tribal law enforcement, known as the Native American Drug and Gang Task Force. And what we do is we work together to impact and ultimately try to stop drug and gang activities that's impacting tribal communities. We also support funding for operations and equipment. We provide training, including recently providing a training to staff members at Ho-Chunk Casino and Hotel on drug trafficking identification. And we're also supporting treatment programs through our treatment alternatives and diversion programs. There are now three tribes that have those programs, and you know, I hope to see that program, the treatment alternatives and diversion program, expanded, and including to more tribes, so that, again, we can make sure that more people are getting the help that they need.
Attorney General Josh Call is with us as we move through a range of issues, looking at what is facing the state this year and in the State Justice Department. Your questions, your priorities for the Department of Justice at 800-642-1234. Attorney General, you tweeted recently that new legislation regarding sexual assault kits isn't about strengthening protections for survivors. You said it's about providing political cover for not passing the old assembly bill. What did you mean by that?
In April of last year, along with a bipartisan group of state legislators and subject matter experts, including nurses, representatives of law enforcement, and advocates for survivors, we introduced legislation that's designed to prevent Wisconsin from ever having another backlog of untested sexual assault kits. It's strong legislation. It would help us prevent a backlog, and it passed the Senate last year on a voice vote. The reason that that legislation hasn't become law is that the Assembly Republicans have refused to even hold a hearing on that legislation. Instead, near the end of session, they introduced an alternative bill that was problematic in a variety of ways. It included some divisive provisions, and they decided to pass that legislation rather than the bipartisan legislation that's passed the Senate. And so what has happened is the Assembly Republicans have effectively killed good legislation that can help prevent another backlog, and that's incredibly disappointing.
Well, knowing what you know now, do you have any 2020 hindsight about the political process on this bill? Would you have done anything differently in the drafting of it to get this legislation through?
No, unfortunately, Assembly Republicans have chosen to prioritize political point counting over getting something done. I mean, this was done with bipartisan support. One of the authors in the Assembly is a member of the Republican Party. We had 56 co-sponsors in the state assembly, so that's a majority of members of the state assembly. And as I said, this passed through the Senate on a voice vote. And, you know, the Senate, which is controlled by Republicans, has indicated that they don't want to take up the bill that the assembly passed. This is the committee chair, Representative Joe Sanfilippo, and Speaker Voss prioritizing political gains over getting something done that can help survivors of sexual assault. I think it's outrageous, and we're going to continue fighting to get something passed.
Do you see a growing backlog right now at all, or is the department on top of kits?
Well, I think it's important that we have this legislation in place so that we, in part because we need to know exactly what's going on around the state. I mean, the backlog that was first identified years ago happened because kits would sit in hospitals or in police evidence rooms and were never submitted to the state crime labs for testing. And one of the things that the bill that I support, that has the bipartisan support, would provide for is a collection of data by the Department of Justice regarding sexual assault kits. And that would allow us to see exactly what's going on with kits around the state. But in the meantime, what we're left to do is to call on hospitals and to call on law enforcement agencies to submit those kits in a timely fashion so that they're tested promptly. But the longer we wait to pass legislation, the more likely it is that we're going to have a recurrence of this problem. It's why it's important that we get legislation passed and that we learn the lessons that led to the prior backlog so it never happens here again in Wisconsin.
Let's spend some time now on vaping. A few days ago, you announced the Wisconsin would join 39 other states in a coalition against e-cigarette manufacturer Juul Labs. How will joining this lawsuit affect vaping among teenagers?
There's been an enormous increase in vaping in Wisconsin and nationally in the last few years. And Juul has been the primary driver of that increase. And one of the things that has been alleged is that Juul has engaged in marketing practices that targeted young people. And so what we are doing with this bipartisan group of nearly 40 states is working together to investigate the sales and marketing practices that Juul used to assess whether the representations that they made were accurate and whether they've been improperly targeting young people with their sales. And if they have been, we're going to take action.
And we
need to make sure that we are reducing vaping in Wisconsin.
What are your thoughts on raising the minimum age for tobacco and vaping from 18 to 21?
I support the legislation that has passed the state assembly. The federal law has now been changed so that the minimum age for the use of tobacco products is 21. That's very clear. But we need to make sure that state law is consistent with federal law so that the enforcement of the laws can be done not only by federal officials, but by state officials as well.
Attorney General Call, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Josh Call is the Attorney General of Wisconsin. Coming up, we look at the Supervised Release Program, which monitors sex offenders. Do you keep tabs on the Wisconsin Sex Offender Registry? Do you search websites that show where offenders live? We have the Supervised Release Program Section Chief with the Department of Health Services coming up right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're talking about the lives of sex offenders in Wisconsin. A recent study found Wisconsin ranks sixth for the most registered sex offenders per capita of any state. The analysis by the site safehome.org used 2019 data from federal and state sources. Has a sex offender recently moved into your neighborhood? Are you concerned or do you feel just as safe? What do you want to know about the supervised release program? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. Alicia Burma is the Supervised Release Program Section Chief with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Alicia, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you work closely with convicted sex offenders and this program. What is it like to be a registered sex offender right now in Wisconsin?
So there are about 26 to 27,000 registered sex offenders in the state of Wisconsin. The supervised release program is a program for individuals who are specifically civilly committed to the Department of Health Services, and those are about 63 individuals in the program currently.
So for those individuals in the program, what is their life like, and how much interaction do you have with them through the program?
So the program has assists the individual in reintegrating into the community. So we have close contact with individuals in the program. Individuals in our program are closely monitored. They have case managers who visit them. They're required to see their DOC agents every week, and they receive specific treatment for sex offender treatment to assist them in the reintegration into the community.
Are they living in a group setting or on their own? What are their living arrangements?
Yep. Most individuals are living in their own residence that's leased by the Department of Health Services. Some have a roommate in the program. Others live by themselves. And if individuals need additional assistance, they might be placed in a group home.
You've attended community meetings all over the state when a certain individual is released in the area that who has committed a sex-related crime. What concerns do you hear from members of the community?
We hear a lot of concerns about knowing that there is someone who's placed near them or next to them. That creates a lot of fear for individuals who live in that area. What's interesting, though, however, is that the fact that we know that an individual is there, they're actually safer because they know where the individual is. Individuals in the supervised release program are closely monitored. Most individuals who commit sex offenses are actually individuals who know that person personally. And so folks in our program, we really try and focus on the reintegration piece. We try to ensure that an individual gets a job and is living healthily in the community. That is the goal of our program.
So when you say closely monitored, do you mean daily contact with the person, weekly, monthly? What is that like?
Yeah, so when a person first comes out statutorily on our program, they're monitored one-on-one with an individual who takes them to where they need to go and is in sight sound and physical access of that individual. So they're actually transported where they need to go, and they're closely monitored. We also monitor individuals by doing random checks on the home. So day or night, we might go into their residence and check to make sure that that they're doing what they need to do and that they're not violating any of the rules of the program. In addition, they have GPS. So an active GPS is run through the Department of Corrections, and there's a 24/7 monitoring center which knows what the person's schedule is. So this person is required to be in their residence unless they have a specific reason to be out of their residence, and then they're actively monitored by the GPS who tracks where they are.
So if you're a concerned citizen, do you have any ability to stop an individual from being relocated into your community or into your neighborhood, perhaps?
So it's interesting, in this program, everyone is court-ordered into the program. So it's a judge that makes a decision about someone coming out into the program. The responsibility of the Department of Health Services then is to do the best job to rehabilitate and reintegrate that individual into the community. So the point of contact for individuals really is through the judge, because the judge is the one that makes the decision in all matters around our program.
And before that judge, you know, or before that you get them in your program, they have lived at the Sand Ridge Secure Treatment Center near Wisconsin Dells, is that right?
Yes. Yeah, so there is, when an individual commits a sex-related crime, typically they go to prison or another institution. Before a person is released, if they've committed certain types of sexual-related crimes, then the district attorney or the Department of Justice files a petition alleging that the person completing their prison sentence meets criteria under Chapter 980. So Chapter 980 is the law which governs the civil commitment process. Then what happens is there is a probable cause hearing to determine if the individual meets the criteria under Chapter 980, and if so, then the court looks at that and determines whether or not an individual is civilly committed to the Department of Health Services under Chapter 980. From there, an individual leaves that institution and goes directly to Sand Ridge Secure Treatment Center, which is an inpatient treatment facility that specifically treats individuals who are committed under Chapter 980. From that point, an individual can petition to come out on supervised release or to be discharged annually, and a judge decides whether or not they stay in the institution, whether or not they can be directly discharged into the community, or whether or not they can continue a civil commitment on a supervised release program, which is the program that we're talking about today.
We're talking with Alicia Burma, the Supervised Release Program Section Chief with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Your thoughts, your questions. What do you want to know about this program? What questions do you have? Are you a mental health professional who treats sex offenders? What do we tend to misunderstand about these individuals? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Alicia, currently there are approximately 24 men waiting to be transferred out of Sand Ridge Secure Treatment Center. Is that number pretty typical?
So, you know, it's interesting. A couple of years ago, Act 184 was passed. It went into effect on March 30th, 2018. Prior to that time, it took a number of days for an individual to come out on supervised release and to find a residence for that individual. In fact, it could take 500 days for an individual to be finally placed. Since the passage of Act 184, counties now are responsible for creating a temporary committee, and that committee searches for residents in that county. And we've seen a lot more successful placements since then. So the flow of individuals out on our program has increased, which is a very positive development.
How does the committee then decide where to place the individual?
So there's statutory criteria around where an individual can live, and it's the individual committee responsibility to look at whether or not a residence meets that criteria. So an individual is not allowed to live less than 1,500 feet from a school, from a daycare, from a church, from a park. And so the committee is responsible for really looking at what residents might meet criteria and finding a residence that meets that criteria, for which then the Department of Health Services is responsible for submitting that recommendation to the court.
There are websites that show you where a convicted sex offender lives. How does this ability to locate these individuals perhaps inform our biases about them?
Yeah, well, I mean, individuals who have committed sexual crimes are one of the most stigmatized groups in society. But these websites, which show where individuals live, is really a tool for the community to be better informed. And the goal is to create a safer community. So by knowing where individuals live, the community can be better informed.
So you are very much in favor of this type of transparency.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we've found, and there was research that was done of individuals out on the supervised release program where they were asked whether or not, as clients, they approved of these websites which inform the community where individuals live. And there was a mixed response. But overall, they felt that it was helpful for individuals to know where they lived. We do want to make sure, however, that individuals are not targeted by the community based on the fact that they've had previous sex offenses. And that is a concern that we have in our program for individuals who are placed.
What might it look like for someone to be targeted?
We've had situations in our program where actually a neighbor tried to burn down a residence where an individual was living. We've had neighbors harass individuals in our program. So by knowing that an individual is living where they're living, they have been targeted. And our goal is to safely reintegrate the individual in the community here in the supervised release program. And so we really want to make sure that we're creating a safe environment for individuals to do that, because we know from research that safe reintegration decreases the number of sexual reoffenses. And that's really our goal in the supervised release program.
We're talking with Alicia Berman, the supervised release program section chief with the Department of Health Services. What do you think about Governor Evers choosing to not change sex offender residency requirements? Do you feel safer knowing offenders live at least 1,500 feet away from schools? Are you a judge? How do you decide which sex offenders should be released to the community? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about where registered sex offenders go after being released from prison or from a mandated treatment program. A state law, as we've been talking about, bars sexually violent people from living less than 1,500 feet from schools, public parks, places of worship, or youth centers. Are you a mental health professional who works with sex offenders? What do we tend to misunderstand? Are you a registered sex offender? What would you say about your release and how your life is today? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Alicia Berma is the Supervised Release Program Section Chief with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, and she stays with us. Let's take a call now. Let's go to John, who joins us from Appleton. Hi, John.
Hi, just have a couple of questions. The first relates to the location of their placement and how close to a police office or a police presence do they need to be housed? The second question is the cost of their housing. I've heard that we pay more than fair market value. So how much do we pay for their rent? And if it's more than fair market value, why is it that price?
John, thanks for those questions. Alicia, can you tackle the police station question first?
Sure. Thank you very much. These are great questions. So there's nothing statutorily that requires that an individual be placed near to a police station. That said, that might be a very good place for an individual to be placed. So while the legislators have not reflected that in statutes. That doesn't mean that a county committee who's looking for a residence for the individual can't take that those kinds of safety and protective factors in account when finding a location for an individual to reside.
And then the second question there about cost, Alicia?
Yes. So in our program, and again, we're talking about a small number of sex offenders. Again, there's about 26 to 27,000 registered sex offenders in the state of Wisconsin, and our program has 63 individuals currently. We do pay above fair market rent for leases. It is very difficult to find landlords who are willing to lease to the Department of Health Services for the purpose of placing a client into that residence. And so we have paid more for residences. And also, landlords are taking on an increased risk because of the community reaction. So I can't underscore enough the community reaction in some areas and how that has impacted both clients and landlords. We look at what is commercially reasonable first. So when we're negotiating a lease, we do look at what is fair market value in that area, and that's the starting point for which we begin to negotiate with that particular landlord.
We're talking with Alicia Berman, the Supervised Release Program Section Chief at the Department of Health Services, and looking at registered sex offenders and their lives after treatment programs. Let's go to Mark now in Green Bay. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, how you doing? Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question for the guest is, I wonder if she could discuss, recidivism rates of the offenders that are committed to her program in particular, and just a follow-up question of whether or not there's any kind of like lie detector monitoring of these offenders. I know some states do that with their programs.
Mark, thanks for the question. Alicia, how often do you see sex offenders that are part of this program reoffend?
Yep. So that's a perfect question. I'm so glad it was asked. In our program, the reason why it's so successful is because of the low recidivism rate for individuals in our program, which is less than 2%. So our program has been in existence since 1994, and there has been less than 2% of individuals in the program who have committed and been convicted of sex-related crimes.
Why do you think that is?
It's really because of the wraparound approach. We've got a full-team approach that monitors and works with the individual to make sure that they're reintegrating successfully. We have a lot of tools in our toolbox to be able to ensure that a person is doing well. And if they're not doing well, we have the ability to make changes to their treatment, to their supervision, to the rules that they have. If somebody's not doing well, they might go back to the institution for a little bit just to work on a few issues before coming out. And we also have the ability to ask the court to revoke a person's civil commitment on supervised release and return them back to Sandridge Secure Treatment Center.
Offenders can also hold down jobs, be employed. How difficult is it for them to find a job and have a steady source of income?
You know, there are many barriers. Again, this is a highly stigmatized group. There are many big barriers to finding employment. However, we found in this job market that people are being very successful in finding employment. And this is a very positive thing because we know that it's a protective factor. So individuals who are working, individuals who are connected to the community, individuals who have these wraparound services, this all speaks to having a more successful outcome for the clients in our program.
When you look at the types of jobs that your clients are getting, what might they be?
Yep. So we approve all employment for clients in our program, in the supervised release program. We do this because we do not allow individuals to work in places that where there are children, for example. A lot of the work that they do are in factories or working cleaning in the evenings, office buildings. So there's quite a few jobs that individuals are approved to do, and we make sure that they're safe.
When do individuals graduate or leave the program? What is that like?
That's an excellent question. So the only way into the program is by court order. So a judge has to look at how the individual is doing. There are psychologists that are hired through the Department of Health Services who evaluate a person's risk, evaluate how they're doing. To come into supervised release, of course, that's a court-ordered process. And again, to leave the program, that's also a court order process. So our program does not invite people into the program or discharge people out of the program. That's all through the court system.
Mark in Green Bay had also asked about the use of lie detectors. Are they being used at all?
Absolutely. In our program, we do have a polygraph. Individuals are required to take them periodically, and we ask questions about whether or not individuals are following rules, whether or not they're engaging in any behaviors that are risky to the community, and we do look at how a person is doing and how they respond to those polygraphs.
Alicia, there can be this perception that a person can't be rehabilitated. Is there something faulty to that thinking?
There is. We have seen a lot of successes on our program. Individuals who leave the program who are leading healthy lives, who have gotten the treatment that they need in order to move forward and be productive members of society, to have stable jobs and to be able to contribute to the community in positive ways. And that really is the goal of the supervised release program and one of the successes. We found that individuals who are a part of our program have much better outcomes than individuals who are directly released from prison or directly released from Sandridge. And that's why this program is so important for the community at large.
In the last moments we have with you, as section chief, what are your greatest challenges? What do you grapple with?
So I think, again, you know, educating the community. There are we participate in community notification meetings, which I find very helpful. Oftentimes in these meetings, people come up to me afterwards and thank us for coming out and really educating people on the program, educating people around how we ensure the safety of the community. So while they might not be pleased that someone's coming out in their community, they feel that the knowledge that they gain from these community notifications are very helpful.
Alicia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Alicia Burma is the Supervised Release Program Section Chief with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Just ahead, it's the growing issues surrounding noise pollution. We look at the latest research on environmental noise and how it affects the health and well-being of our communities. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.